The podcast about the many and varied journeys of Australia's ex-service men, women and their families, brought to you by RSL Victoria.
In each episode, we'll interview a guest, sometimes two, about their life in service and life after service, exploring the many highlights and challenges that they may have faced along the way.
Beyond the Barracks is a podcast for veterans and their families to tell their stories. Sometimes we may discuss experiences and issues that some listeners may find distressing. Please check the show notes for support services.
We acknowledge that this podcast is being recorded on the traditional lands of the Wurundjeri Woi Wurrung people of the Kulin Nation and pay our respects to elders past, present and emerging. RSL Victoria and the Beyond the Barracks team recognises the service of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples, just as we recognise the service of all Australians. We are proud of the contribution they have made and continue to make to the Australian Defence Force.
So, Harry, on today's episode of Beyond the Barracks, we've got Brett West joining us. He's a Yamatji man who comes from his traditional land in Western Australia and decided as a young boy growing up that he'd like to serve with the Royal Australian Air Force, which he then did for about 30 years.
Yeah, and I believe he's had a deep family history in service and Air Force and Army that he discovers. So I'm keen to hear a bit more about that, how that unfolded for him.
And I think that whole journey probably then just helped to cement his connection to his service and his cultural link. So I'm excited to hear from him about his journey through service and post-service and his connection back to his land and why that's important.
Yeah, and that's right. There's a real education here for us all about the journey of Indigenous people, but specifically in their service life. We don't often hear much about it when you think about it. So, yeah, really excited for this. And yeah, I can't wait to ask him a bit about his connection back to WA too, because I've spent a bit of time there myself. So, yeah, looking forward to talking to him.
Me too. Should be interesting. Brett, thank you very much for joining us today. We're really honoured to have you here as our guest. And what we'd like to start off, Harry and I would like to start off with an acknowledgement of country. So we'd like to acknowledge that this podcast is being recorded on the traditional lands of the Wurundjeri Woi Wurrung people of the Kulin Nation and pay our respect to elders past, present and emerging.
And just for everybody out there, the RSL Victorian, we at Beyond the Barracks recognise the service of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples, of all defence members and servicemen and women, and we're proud of the contribution that that all members have made to the country and the ADF. Important to you as well, Brett, being an Indigenous man and served our country. Is there anything you'd like to say to start?
Yeah, look, especially myself as a Yamatji man, so my traditional lands and waters are about 4,000 k's west of here, and I definitely want to first acknowledge that lands have never been ceded, but the other thing also too is the Wurrung speaking people of the Wurundjeri Nation. I want to thank them actually for looking after this country that we're meeting on at the moment for tens of thousands of years. I actually live on their country and have for a while, so I want to pay my respects right through from their ancestors and their big shoulders to stand on, and especially for me, not just as an Aboriginal person, but as you said, an Aboriginal serviceman,
yep.
Now veteran. I want to definitely pay respects right back to the ancestors and to now the youngsters that are coming through, which will be our future leaders.
Just before we kind of get into your veteran service, so Yamatji man.
Yamatji, yep.
Do you feel the distance, you know, being here, you couldn't be further away in the country, really, from your native land, I suppose, if that's the right
traditional
term,
lands,
traditional land to use, to use the right term. Yeah, do you feel the distance? Is that something?
When you say feel the distance, so what I need to do is reconnect with country. So I make sure that I go back. I used to try and do it like, you know, every year. And then it was like, oh, maybe I don't need it that often, every couple of years. The thing that I've found, and I guess especially with age, it has been that whole thing of is it really comes down to when I need it. And yeah, when okay. I say when I need it, it's not only for me, my family and my community,
yeah.
when it is right and it's appropriate, as I said, I'll make sure I go home.
What we would love to understand more from you is your connection to your culture and how that has inspired and influenced your journey through your service and your tradition, your transition out and that desire to want to give back into your communities. Mm. So maybe we take us back, Brett, to when your service began. It was the late 80s.
Or mid to late 80s.
Yep.
Mid-80s, yeah. Yeah, so joined in 87, actually. Well, so my records say 87. I tried to join in – well, I joined in 86, but so in those days, and it probably still is the case, when you actually when you enlist, any type of course you've got to do and what have you, there's a kind of suite of courses that goes in. You do the appropriate or requisite type paperwork. And then you stand there. It's a bit like catching a tram. You have to wait for the next one.
Yeah,
so,
right.
So yep. It was, yeah, so late 86 I actually joined but didn't get on a what we called rookie, so the recruit course, until 87.
And why? Why did you decide to enlist? I mean, you grew up, I think, in quite a small country area of WA. Where did you get the idea to want to serve?
Mm. You're right. So I was brought up in a small country town called Carnarvon. And as a kid, I remember, so one of the things, especially when my very early years, we pretty much lived in the bush. So it was, I was like a block, they called it the block, but it was like a kind of reserve for, you know, Aboriginal peoples. And so kind of wandering around there, one of the things that really kind of struck me was, so it was a small airport into Carnarvon. And there was little, what I term bug smashers. So these little kind of prop jobs. I couldn't even tell you what kind of aircraft they were, but that was the only thing that came in. But I was always fascinated, like, you know, these things fly in and fly out. They were nothing like anything else around, you know, the town. And I always kind of wondered, I think first and foremost my wonder was, wow, that'd be pretty cool actually to, you know, go up and get out of here. But the other thing also too is, and as I grew older, was that whole thing of, gee, I wonder what makes them tick. So I was probably lucky I had a bit of a kind of mechanical brain or a want thereof. My later years, my parents took us, so there was, I've got two brothers, took us down to Perth where I did my later schooling. It's amazing how things don't come up and you don't discuss things or your father doesn't discuss things until all of a sudden I think it's like they deem it the right time. So anyway, it was a matter of, you know, finishing schooling. I still had this kind of bent of like, you know, I still think aircraft are pretty cool. And Dad all of a sudden comes out with, oh, yeah, I used to be in the Air Cadets. To which I went, that's interesting.
Didn't see that coming.
No. Yeah. I'm almost 16, 17 years of age and that's wow. come out. But it was really cool actually because we were able to talk and connect on that level. That said, I never had any issues with kind of connecting with my father. But the interesting thing was this was just another area to do that honestly I would never have kind of picked. Then all of a sudden, yeah, he was telling me about how, you know, how good the Air Cadets was. He got his glider license, how he really wished he joined the Air Force. And I'm going, oh, okay, wow. Okay. Yeah, so that's how it all kind of really came about. It really was that whole thing of finished school. I did go to uni for a bit. And then I went, oh, no, worked on a station for a while. But it was literally just like there was this kind of burning in me that kind of went, well, why don't you give it a whirl?
Mm.
And so I went to the TAFE, the local TAFE, and said, I'd like to actually study electronics and look at this, you know, from an aerospace perspective. And they went, nah, no hope, mate. So I go and join the Air Force and they go, yeah, hell, come on
yeah,
up. Yeah,
sign
so,
up.
Which is really interesting.
Yeah. Right, yeah. And how was your decision to enlist seen by your parents? I mean, was your dad particularly proud?
Yeah, well, it was the only time I think I saw Dad do a cartwheel. So no. So he was super proud. Mum was super proud. And it was interesting, I think, because – they were proud, but coming from two different reasons for being proud. I said Dad was uber proud because, you know, he'd had that kind of want, if you like, that to join the kind of Air Force. And it wasn't – that was the other thing too. It wasn't military. It was Air Force, you know, that he really kind of was talking to. And then the other one, I think Mum was, like, just super proud that, you know, her son, but her Aboriginal son, and, you know, throughout my schooling and stuff, it wasn't exactly the easiest thing with the kind of racism within the schooling system or what have you. But, you know, going through that, and, I think she was pretty proud that there was another kind of Aboriginal person that was joining. The other thing I didn't mention actually is, again, you don't discuss these things with your parents until such time that they believe they need to. But then I actually learnt of my uncle. So I had an uncle, Andy, so Andrew Drummond, who actually served with 5RAR in Vietnam. Unfortunately, lost his life just before I was born. Oh. So I was born in June 69. Mm-hmm. He lost his life, unfortunately, over there in May 69. But then all of a sudden, all those stories came out. So it was almost a surreal time because it was not just that. Yeah, actually, I'll give this a whirl. But it was really this whole thing of all of these stories coming out from my parents that I had no idea about until such time that all of a sudden it was there. So, yeah, it was almost like this kind of perfect storm.
Yeah.
You know, if oh,
all roads were kind of pointing you along, and then it's crystallised in this 6 month or 12 month period, whatever it was.
It makes
sense, but doesn't it? Your yearning, and you said you was kind of a desire and interest in aircraft.
But making sense was, as I said, an interesting one because it was like almost walking down this road, and then all of a sudden all these roads kind of not only merged, but it made sense to merge.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, okay.
I'm curious, Brett, you touched on, you know, that there were obviously some challenges, I think, in Carnarvon growing up with some racism at school, that sort of thing. What can I ask, if you'd like to share with us, what was that like then finishing school and deciding to join the Air Force? Were you welcomed? How did that feel back then? Was it did you move away from the race issue as such?
It was actually really interesting because the racism, the race issue was there not only in the small country town that I grew up in, but even when I went to Perth. So when I joined, there wasn't this feeling of, oh, okay, you know, I'll put that behind me. It really was just that whole thing of this is the next step in life and whatever, you know, that brings, which includes if unfortunately there's, you know, some race issues, some racism, discrimination, that, you know what, I've been dealing with this for like 17 years, I'll just deal with it again. So it wasn't first and foremost in my mind. One of the things though that in those that first time that I was in, so it had rookies, as I said, that was recruit training is what we used to call recruit training. That was at Adelaide. Edinburgh actually. So about 3 months there, then we had what they call ITE, so the initial employment training, or IET, which for me was aircraft training. And actually there I specialised in weaponry. So while doing all that, one of the things that I had was it was all about the team. It was all about the service. And so I have to admit, I suppose I probably kind of really fell into that and went, wow, you know, we are all treated equal. And it really was. And I found that actually throughout my career. It was that whole thing of, you know, didn't matter what kind of colour you were, creed, culture, that kind of thing, you're all treated equal. So initially that was great. And I will probably talk a bit later on about what that meant to me later on in life. But, yeah, at that time, and probably, as I said, especially, you know, 17, 18 years at school, or actually and in general society, having that you know, discrimination, what have you, it felt like a pretty good fit.
And so was service, I mean, everything that you'd sort of in your mind as a young boy, fascination with planes and travelling and all that sort of stuff, did that come to fruition? I mean, you went on a few deployments. Did it match up to everything that you had created it to be?
Well, again, I have to admit that my expectations weren't overly high when I first joined, and that's not the that's not me trying to make sure that I'm not let down. It's got nothing to do with it's got everything to do with the fact that even though I was pretty keen on travel, I was pretty keen on aircraft, I still didn't have any kind of real inkling about what this meant. So so as I was going through though, and there was this kind of thing that, so I was in Wagga doing my initial employment training. I got really homesick, and I remember talking to Dad, and Dad, was pretty much, get through it. Thanks, Dad. That's great advice.
Yeah.
But Mum was talking about, look, not just stick it out, but and it was the first time that we started to actually talk about the reasons. So I get, there's probably many reasons that people get kind of homesick. And I came to a realization with a number of phone calls to Mum was my homesickness actually wasn't about my parents. It was actually a yearning for country. Mm. So I kind of went, oh, okay. And then that was a bit of a journey as well. Like, and as I said, I guess I'd never really thought of it before because I was either on country or even though Perth is about 900 k south of Carnarvon,
yep.
We always ventured up there. We were always catching up with family and stuff. So I was never away from country for any length of time. And this was not just the Great Divide. I was on the other side of the country. It was more a matter of, wow, it's been a couple of years and I still haven't been back.
My first understanding of the connection to country comes from Townsville around that same time, late 80s. I served there until 90 in Townsville. And it was the first time it came into my consciousness that there was the return to country. And we had, I'm just white fella as, I had no real exposure until I joined the military where there were a couple of Indigenous guys in our SIG unit. And, I have great friendships and they'd talk about it. And it was referred to in other ways but back then. But it's that kind of was behind my initial question, kind of the feeling that it's something that's intriguing to me, Were you supported in that time around that?
Certain units.
Yeah.
Yeah, so certain units that had really understanding either commanding officers or the admin officers. Usually if you had someone there, they were great.
Yeah.
And it was really funny because at times it was like, I don't get it, but I know that I have to do this. And as I said, that was just as good for me as for them to say, no, I kind of get it and sending me away. I remember actually, again, when I was at Wagga, and this is my initial training and stuff, and my grandfather passed away. And it was, I've kind of gone, look, I've got to go home. And I have to admit, because I was just a troop at the time, and I'll never forget, like, the corporals and that going, mate, I get it, you might have been close to your grandfather, but your grandfather's passed, mate, like, you'd be right. We'll go have a couple of beers and it'd be kosher. And I kind of went, nah, man, can't do this. And it was, so I went to one of the senior guys, so what you guys call a WO2, so a flight sergeant, and I'll never forget him, Spotty Dunn was his name. And he's kind of going, so what's the story, mate? And I said, look, my grandfather's passed away. And he goes, oh, okay, so what does that mean? And I said, it's pretty much like you and if your brother passed away. And he said, well, now that you've explained that to me. And the really interesting thing was, though, and I can say this now, I suppose, because I don't think I'm actually going to be done for fraud. I think it's been long enough, was the policy didn't allow it. So pretty much it was funny because we're having this interview and he's going, I'll get you home. But you used to live with your grandfather, didn't you? I went, what? He goes, mate, used to live with your grandfather. And I'm kind of going, I kind of cottoned on.
Well, for context, in the military, it's direct family members, and I think it's still the same. You get the compassionate leave tick. And so it might sound strange we're having this conversation to a civilian listening, for example, who go, well, of course he went home to see his grandma. Well, in the military, you have to take your own leave, pay your own way, and
not just that. Yeah. I was on initial employment training. You cannot leave that. Unless I've never forgotten that. That guy has said Spotty Dunn. I can't remember his actual real first name, but great guy, great understanding, wonderful leader. And it was just things like that, quiet as, and he'd just come out with stuff like that. So that was my first kind of feeling that, you know, this job might be different. So.
Mm. Was there a light bulb moment, I guess, so to speak, in your service where you kind of went, okay, I'm not just in this to serve, but I'm in this for my people, for my, for my heritage, my culture? Was there a switch in your thinking at all?
So I'd done probably 10 odd years, so probably 10 to 12 years. And one of the things that I'm a pretty slow learner, so takes a while for the penny to drop. But I'll never forget one of the things, and I'm just trying to remember the actual impetus. But the long and short of it was, I had this, as you say, this kind of epiphany moment. Mm. But the first epiphany moment I had was this whole thing of, I was talking to some cousins and that, and we were talking about, you know, country, but we're also talking about the men and what the way that we were the warriors and we need to look after our people and stuff. And it really kind of came to me, and I was discussing with a couple of other Aboriginal servicemen as well, that all of a sudden it was that whole thing of, yes, okay, so we've got this kind of warrior culture and this is actually where it fits. And it wasn't right up until, but it was, so it would have been probably around the mid to late 90s, because you remember this, you know, we were kind of a peacekeeping force, mm-hmm. right? And so all of a sudden it was, I was having these kind of moments of, oh, okay, what does this mean? And then Timor flew up and all of a sudden we're like, oh, hang on, that's right, that's what we do. Yeah. So, sorry.
No, it's true. That's exactly what it was like in the 90s.
No, it was. Yeah. And so for me, that first epiphany moment was, wow, I'm actually here to defend country. Yeah. And that was a real one. There was a bunch of us that actually really kind of went almost, if you like, back to our roots in our minds with regards to that kind of not only warrior instinct but also that thing of we're here to protect and defend country.
It kind of makes it tangible, makes it real, brings it in, makes it concrete, does it?
Honestly, it was more for me. It was actually the first kind of merging, if you like, of my Aboriginal culture that I could actually see.
Yeah, that's interesting.
That I could actually see, hang on, this is not something that
these things are not mutually exclusive.
So excuse my French, but it's not what you Wadjalas. So Wadjalas is white fellas in my language, in my Yamaji language.
Great. I love it. Say that again.
Yamaji. I'm a Wadjala.
Wadjala. Okay.
So all of a sudden it was that whole thing of I'm not as you said, it's not mutually exclusive. I'm not in this kind of Wadjala construct doing stuff for them. It's actually, no, this has got to do with my mob, our people to actually think. So, yeah, so that was my first kind of, if you like, epiphany moment. The second epiphany moment was probably, so I was posted back to Perth. That was interesting. And I was a senior, so I was a flight sergeant, so what you guys would call a way too. So fairly senior, had my own kind of unit and what have you. And then I had a cousin pass away. And we were super close. And when I say super close, it was a matter of not only obviously we get on really well and what have you, but it was that kind of lineage and where we sat in the family. We were virtually kind of soulmates. So there's a few kind of cousins that I have that are exactly like that. And anyway, so she passed and we were actually due to go on an exercise. And I said, mate, I can't do this. There was a change of CO at the time, actually. I won't mention his name. won't mention what I think of him as well. but it was this kind of whole thing. And it really upset me to the point that I couldn't concentrate on work and stuff. And it was, like I said, I need to get back for the – because the funeral this was an interesting – because the funeral was actually traditional. So we had a Murrumbin man. So what in my language, so that's like a I hate to use the word, but witch doctor. So a lawman. Sorry.
Right, yeah.
So a lawman that was performing the ceremony, the burial itself was on country, right, on traditional land, so not in a cemetery. Like, so, for me it was like, wow, this is something you can't miss. I was copping heat for it, and I just went, are you kidding me? So the big thing for me in that time of my life, which would have been around the 20-year mark or whatever, that was when I kind of went, wow, hang on, there is something here that equality isn't exactly, you know, the kind of utopia. And that was when, yeah, it wasn't just, you know, what I was feeling and what I was doing, discussions with other, especially other Aboriginal kind of colleagues and stuff, but more a matter of, I have to admit, I did a bit of kind of study in that. It was that whole thing of, you know, no, what we need is equity, you know, not equality. Everyone's not the same, and we can't treat everyone the same, but we need to treat everyone fairly, but come at, you know, come at things to them at the point that they are.
So I like the way you brought together, used the Timor experience to kind of bring both purposes together, if you will. I mean, to you know, play to your indigenous purpose and also service to the country. Yeah. I suppose service to country in both ways, but I'm sure it wasn't like that all the time. Brett, you know, that there was reminders inside defence. I know from, you know, that time and experience, and I'm only discharged a few years ago. It must be a very challenging environment at times for you along your journey in service, being an Indigenous man and being in the, as you say, the Wadjila construct, you know.
So probably from those, as I said, those epiphany moments, especially the later one, it really got me thinking. And first and foremost, it was especially going so the difference between when I talk about on exercise and on deployment, I'm not sure if Army use the same terminology. I know the Navy don't. They deploy everywhere apparently.
Who knows what the Navy
does, mate? Right. And I
take all our money, that's
exactly
for sure.
And I say that because my son's actually serving at the moment in the Navy, but they're a different breed.
They are. My man's Navy, but yeah. But that's not to say they're not the different breed.
No, that's right, yeah. So so exercise was non-warlike, you know, you'd go and do you know, you operate how you would in a war, but it's not in a warlike situation, whereas deployments are part of like a warlike situation. So when the deployments, especially after Timor and stuff, started to get more serious, and then also too when we were deploying, so from, you know, straight after Timor, 2003, all of a sudden the Middle East kind of springs up. Honestly, the thing for me is going into these areas, and again, even on exercise overseas, I had this kind of real, it was almost like out-of-body experience where I was literally going, but what about the people here? You know, they are of this land. I really want to know about them. And so every now and again, people get annoyed, especially because I was like a senior. It's like Warren off. So they go, he's disappeared again, man. Like, where is he? And I'd go into, you know, whether it be villages or stuff like that, whatever, just to talk to the locals. And even if, as I said, they didn't speak English, it really was just a matter
of to get a sense of who they are, just, the culture.
It'd be amazing when you just sit there and a few kind of little hand signals and stuff that you can communicate. And then there's always that beauty of food. So you sit down and have a eat something or whatever, and it was great. So I was doing this thing of I want to actually feel this country, and the other way that change was doing that was this whole thing of then. And I suppose I can say this, I'm not serving anymore. Should we really be here? Like, are we actually doing the right thing? So
I think that's, with serving or not, I don't think that's a wrong question to ask. Every serviceman and woman should be asking the same question. And ultimately, I hope, you know, for me it was more about I'm happy to go anywhere in the world and protect vulnerable people against arseholes. You know, that's kind of how I just summarised that up in mind, whether that's kind of, you know, retrospectively. But I think we should always be asking, because war's not the solution. You know, it's not the hammer for every nail. And, you know, for Iraq, for example, I didn't agree with that. But I agreed that, all right, well, if we're going in, this is my duty, my calling, my mates are going, and there's vulnerable people there. But yeah, so I don't feel uncomfortable about that. I think that's a really great, that's a profound question that everyone should ask.
I think the other thing also too that I learnt was it wasn't like the 60s westerns that we watched. For me, it was a matter of everyone that wears a white hat's not necessarily the good guy.
That's right.
And those that wear the black hats aren't necessarily the bad guys.
Correct. I was talking earlier to one of the engineers here about, I think some of the deepest philosophers I've met have been people who've had military service, you know, and it goes back to the philosopher, the ancient philosophers, Socrates and all these mates. They all had service as a, you know, was compelled to do that in their lifetime. And I think when you have seen what the fringes of warfare and then everything that goes to its very core, it's hard not to have a philosophical, you know, position on life, you know.
You know, the other kind of component to that that I think really bears out, as you said, the philosopher in those that serve, is one of the things I loved was the diversity of the people that you serve with.
Yeah.
Because literally it was, you know, especially like when you first joined, I remember rookies and like we were flown in or driven in or what have you from all around the country, right, thrown in, as you say, shaved bald.
Yeah, that's right.
And all gone, right, you're all going to get on. And we all looked at each other going,
you had to.
So, sorry, mate, who are you again and where are you from?
Yeah.
But the other thing with that I found, especially as you go on, and especially with the kind of cohort, and I talk about cohort because of those that have served for, you know, that period of time. So it's not necessarily age because, you join up. I was a fresh-faced 17-year-old and I was joining up with, you know, guys that were like 30-odd. But it's more a matter of you've done X amount of years. And I think that's that also too. It's not just a matter of, wow, we've chewed the same dirt, but I've done it in a different way.
Yeah.
And it's like, wow, okay, that's interesting. I wouldn't have looked at it that way. So,
Brett, what kept it fresh and exciting for you? Was there a diverse range of roles that you did in that time, or why did you keep going back for more year after year?
Well, it was really interesting. Initially, it was just the excitement. We used to travel all the time. Like, as I said, we were a peacetime contingent. And I say that, you know, with not only with no malice, but I definitely don't say that to say that it was a bad time, but we travelled quite a bit. And so as a young guy, and especially, you know, going through the ranks and I was an NCO, but at the same time you could still kind of play it with the boys. So it was really that whole thing of really happy with the kind of slate that I had in life, and it worked out well with a great bunch of people. And so at the time I was serving on fighter aircraft. And so, so it was a matter of getting around with that. That's what kept me happy. Then it was that whole thing of there might be more. And I was really lucky. Like you'd understand this. Like the military is actually like a microcosm of society. Mm. So literally, as I said, it was like so the first one after working on aircraft, and especially the weaponry on aircraft and the systems to do that, my first kind of semi-sojourn out of that was what we're talking about, EOD. So firstly demolitions, but then, you know, wearing a bomb suit and all that kind of stuff. So it wasn't that much of a difference. When I say not much of a difference, the engineering aspect of it is still fairly the same. So from an electronics perspective, from a chemical perspective. So that was all still fairly similar. But then it was a matter of and to this day I still couldn't tell you why. I've actually kind of laboured at this, especially when you guys were so nice and invited me to talk this. I have to admit I have been thinking a bit about it.
Good.
But I have to admit that – so I went, wow, okay, so I've done all this. So they used to have these things called field training flights. We're virtually like little TAFEs on each of the bases. And I went, I want to teach. Mm-hmm. And so that's where I went. So I was a trainer there, also a courseware developer, and that kind of change was great. And since then, or the latter years, you know, I was in logistics. I was in with my kind of EOD bracket, what have you, was explosive inspection. So there was all these range. Oh, and HR was probably when I was getting out was my last one. And when I mean HR, so it was actually looking after the kind of what we call posting. So, you know, when you move your kind of people around, but giving specialist advice on what that would mean for Aboriginal people. And that gets back to that whole thing of country.
Yeah. Yep.
So actually discussing with and I don't mean this rudely, but again, Wajala white manners or those that were, you know, doing the kind of posting plots, so moving people around, getting them to understand, I get it, from a skill set perspective, from a workforce perspective, or even a place perspective, this won't make sense. But this is the reason that person needs to go here. Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
was it a conscious effort on your part to, within your service years and even since your discharge, to consciously make an effort to work in Indigenous engagement roles and positions?
Not initially.
Okay.
It came about, well, really, it was that whole thing of, I think, you know, I was an NCO, senior NCO at the time, and they were going, look, you'd probably make a good role model. I was sitting there with a hangover going, probably not. but it really was that whole thing of it developed. So I was always someone that, you know, if you want me to do something, hey, yeah, all good. I'll give it a whirl. And it was some really initial courses that they were running for and it was even before looking at getting more Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander men and women into the forces. It was more a matter of actually increasing the understanding of non-Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders about Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander culture.
Definitely, yeah.
So I was involved in that, and then came actually a heap of courses. So courses known as the IPRC, which was the Indigenous pre-recruit course, IPRP, which was a similar sort of thing, DIDP, which was the Defence Indigenous Development Program. So these were all programs that are pretty much programs that are designed for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders that don't quite meet the requirements for recruitment. And so it's pretty much like a rookie's course, but it's to work up to the required academic areas, fitness, nutrition, all of those kind of things. So some of those things, honestly, that people take for granted. But the other thing, and what I loved about them was, and this is the reason that you had Aboriginal staff on there, was we gave it a cultural overlay to ensure that it was culturally safe, that it was culturally inclusive. And the other thing also too is we used to discuss the things of it's that whole adage of you can't be what you can't see. So it wasn't just, you know, like for me, the black face in a blue uniform, but it was also too that I used to talk about those that had served before us. You know, those great men and women that on whose shoulders that we thought, like, yeah, Reg Saunders.
Yeah,
exactly.
I had the privilege of going up to Kapooka, and I was at DFR. I think you did a stint at DFR. Did you do recruiting?
I did a stint with DFR.
That was my last posting, and I had the privilege to go up, and they had. Oh, they had a whole array of supports for different people at different stages of career. What do they call it? The kids could go gap year stuff, and the Indigenous program up there was pretty young. Some of them,
yeah.
and the enthusiasm and the excitement was, you know, there was a chance. But I was really impressed that we had. Oh, no, the military's funny. It's frustrating and impress you and frustrate you at the same time, you know. It's
yep.
Part of me where I go, and I can only imagine, part of me going, really, why aren't we accelerating this? There's just so much more we could be doing. Why has it taken this long? What did you see by the time you're at the end of your career, you know, what's impressed you with the military that's doing well, done well, and what are the things we've still got left to do?
So it definitely has
massive questions.
So one of the things that I found, and that was the reason also too that I went to DP, so the Director of Personnel, which is a HR role that I'm talking about. The reason I went for that was I wanted to see a change, and the change twofold. So it's that whole thing of if you want to speak of or make a place more inclusive, honestly, you need more people in. It's one of the things that people don't understand, like even with gender, say women.
Yeah.
You know, you kind of go, oh, we want to make this a more inclusive place for women.
Mm-hmm.
All right, let's have quotas and bring women in. Oh, quotas aren't going to be the answer. Yes, it is. Mm. The only people that know what women want are women. So, and it's the same for Aboriginal people, right, you know. Oh, we should, you know, and again, that was that kind of push of let's get more Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders into the services. Well, okay, why would we want to do that? We want it, you know, safer. We want it more responsive and inclusive for Aboriginal people. I know we can do that. how are you going to do that? You are a white man. Like, exactly. How does that work? Yeah. So anyway, so
it hasn't really worked for us so far.
Yeah,
so
that's right. Yeah.
We'll take it from you guys.
Yeah.
Was it the Wadjalokan?
Yeah, that's right. So for me, it was like, yep, yeah, okay, yeah, I want to look at this. And I have to admit, in my time there was some incredible leaps and bounds that happened. And again, that's not just from an Aboriginal perspective. As I said, it was gender, LGBTIQ, the whole kind of range. It was really cool. So much so, and I have to mention this. One of the things I absolutely loved in my time was so Air Force was the first service to actually introduce an elder.
Right.
And so we had an Air Force elder. Yeah. Harry Alley, incredible guy. Uncle Harry Alley, sorry.
Yeah.
Incredible guy. And it was. The thing I loved about it was recognition, obviously, of not only our culture, but also I think an aspect of our culture that is a little foreign. Mm. Like, and please don't take this the wrong way.
No.
One of the things that I find with kind of Anglo-Saxon, Anglo-Celtic type people is there's not this kind of reverence and what you want to do and look after your old people. Like for us, so my people, excuse me, the only people that honestly matter are the youngsters, they're our little grannies, and the old people. They're the knowledge holders. They're the ones you've got to put in the knowledge into.
Mm.
We're all just worker bees.
Yeah.
So it was really nice to kind of have that and we'll go, wow, okay, so, you know, we've kind of recognised this.
I agree with you. The way we treat in the anglicised world our old people.
Mm.
I mean, it's yeah. My mum worked in old people's homes, and it makes me shudder.
Yeah,
you know? And I think we have to a degree.
Yeah.
Sorry, continue.
Yeah. Yeah, so that, and as I say, so that was you know, probably the one thing. The thing I will say though is that it's come to a point, when I was still serving, it gets to a point where, so to give you an example, probably the stuff that I still don't see, and as I said, I have a little bit of a hand in it. I've still got a number of friends that serve, and my son serves. So there's some great philosophical debates that we have, thanks to Carlton United Breweries. it gets to a point where all of a sudden it's like, oh, no, hang on. And the example I'll give is that whole thing of having Aboriginal perspectives and Aboriginal ideas first and foremost. So, you know, they're still not there. One of the things I will say, though, and maybe this is what we're getting to shortly, is that defence is still so far ahead of the ESO or the transitions piece.
Mm.
Like, literally, I have to admit, for me, that was one of the things that, I suppose the correct word is surprised me. No, actually, it disappointed me was when you step out of that, I have no qualms with general society, right, isn't, you know, a utopia. Get that. All good, especially if you're different. Like, as I said, if you're female, if you're Aboriginal, I had no kind of expectations that all of a sudden it was like, you know, oh, wow, this has been pretty cool and, you know, that thing. The thing that really annoyed me was in the ESO, so the Ex Services Organisations, right, and I probably shouldn't be saying this. See, I just saw the RSL Victoria thing behind
it. Go for it, mate.
One of the things that really annoyed me was they not only hadn't moved on, right, but in certain cases they were worse than bloody mainstream society. But the other thing also too for me is like I go – hang on, so you virtually your clientele are coming from an area that is so much more inclusive. Like, I'm sitting there going, how does that work?
So the ESOs can, you know, for those listening, there's room for them to improve and provide better support to Indigenous people transitioning from services.
I'll give you an example. So I was asked to deliver a speech about my service, but I also wanted to discuss it from, you know, being an Indigenous serviceman but then going into veteran status. And because I speak of these kind of three worlds, which I will discuss in a minute, but one of the ESOs, a major ESO, came up to me and said, look, I think we're doing all right. And I kind of, I'll wear that. I'll go, yeah, cool, too easy. But they said, but you reckon, you know, we're probably not. And I went, well, I haven't done any great studies on your particular organisation, but if I was going to lay money, I know where I'd put it. Anyway, she goes, oh, no, no, what is it that you can do to prove to me that we're either doing a good job or not doing a good job? And I said, all right, so how many Aboriginal veterans do you have or have you had in your service?
Providing support to you, mate. Yeah.
And she went, yep, got it.
Yeah.
You know, it was this penny drop moment
that
I kind of went, if and it's not just Aboriginal, but if any cohort is not accessing your services and you are a major ESO that provides services far and wide, you've got to look at yourself.
Yeah. I think it's a great call, and I've actually heard in some quarters the same for women.
Yep.
But although that's I think probably a better outcome, also it's only been recently, really, in a lot of cases where we've had other people other nationalities or people from, you know, from other backgrounds. For example, Muslims and others. So I think we're good enough to do it. You know, there's a lot of people go, oh, it's all woke, that's just rubbish. That's unintellectual, and I think we're sophisticated enough to be a bit better. And I'm glad, you know, thanks for sharing that, because I think that's, you know, part of what we want to do at Beyond the Barracks is share those transitional challenges.
Yep.
That's key focus.
And I think, I mean, there's so much to talk about in so little time. You're almost like a two-part episode, Brett.
Yeah. Maybe that's something.
I think we would also like to know is, from memory, I think in our previous discussions that I've had with you, Brett, your transition out was what you described as a daunting experience. Mm. What made that difficult for you? Was it the lack of preparedness to transition out, or did it come as a shock to the system? You'd expected to serve much longer than you did. What were those challenges for you?
No, look, for me, even though I wouldn't say that, you know, I went, oh, right, that's it, I'm out, it wasn't like, oh, my God, like, you know, I can't get out and what have you. So, for me, and I think I have talked to you about this before, it's like falling off a cliff.
Mm.
It literally is. I'm serving. I have no idea where I'm at. Mm. And, you know, I've had this debate with some ESOs or those that are very passionate about the ESO area, saying, well, you know, you've got to do the righty, and, you know, if you're not involved in transition seminars, which are the seminars that they have for those that are getting out. And that's another thing they say, oh, yeah, you need to do it 5 years before you get out. And I'll go, who in God's name is planning something that major and going, you know what, 5 years out, this is what I'll be doing. So for me, it's that whole thing of there should be this kind of soft handover, right, to and I don't care who it is. Like, literally, and especially for some people, I guess, like kind of what you're alluding to, some people don't want to get out and they're getting out for reasons that are beyond their control. But for me, that and the person that goes, oh, I've had enough and want to get out, they should be provided the service the transition to where they need to be regardless.
Mm.
So, and like, yeah, for me, like, and I think I said, because I've only just been kind of doing work with RSL Victoria, because I was kind of talked into it for the last couple of years, since probably COVID actually. I didn't touch an ESO. I had no trust in them. I still haven't actually had any dealings with DVA, which, you know, people keep telling me, oh, my God, you know, you're a wreck, so you should go and get hold of them. And I was like, well, it's this whole thing of – and for me, so it's not just being a veteran or an ex-serving member who has reservations. I have reservations because they're not safe environments – they're not environments that have met me, i.e. when I was getting out, but they definitely don't meet my needs from my Aboriginality. So they're not culturally safe. They're not culturally responsive. So, sorry, but why in God's name would people like myself, women, as you said, you know, Muslim serving people and what have you, anyone that served in warlike operations post 91. Mm. There's all these cohorts that literally have not been catered for, and then they wonder why, wow, what's happening? Why can't we get numbers? I have this joke. So the guy that actually wrote me into helping at RSL Victoria, used to be their chief of veteran service. I think he was their inaugural one. Great bloke. Anyway, we used to have drinks because it was that whole thing of you go, yeah, I want you on board because I want to have a look at how we can make RSL Victoria, and here I am bagging the people paying for this, but anyway, more inclusive. Mm. And so, yeah, there'll be times when we're banging our head against the wall. And like I said, I just don't understand it. Like, to look at this like a business, that if you go from 10 years' time, there's going to be five old white guys high-fiving each other, sipping sherry, and that's the RSL.
Mm.
Like, literally. So
I think it's trying and getting people like yourself to come on board and kind of, you know, skull drag you along at times. But I was the same. But one thing that gives me great faith is that the men and women in the RSL and all over the country. We just talked to the president of Rochester and the amazing work the RSL did up there amongst all the community. Not to say they did better or worse, but they leapt to action. I think that the RSL's on a journey. A lot of ESOs are on a journey. I think something you've highlighted during this chat is the, you know, there is still a big gap between the Defence Force handing over the soft hands into the ESO. And I think you really capture when you said the ESOs tend to operate like businesses, which corporatises them, which is kind of the antithesis of what we need for them to progress. And I know there's a lot of hard work going on, particularly at RSL Victoria, to kind of change that. It's a lot of systemic barriers, and you know only too well that we're up against. But, we hope that we can have our little one conversation at a time and open up those communication lines at least.
And I think I feel like this would be very much a Harry question to ask, but what advice would you give to young Indigenous men and women who are serving, transitioning out, something that perhaps you wish you knew or were advised in hindsight? What would you pass on? Because I think this is as much about educating people as it is about getting your story out.
This is going to sound really crass, but listen to the old farts. I have to admit, some of the stuff that I look back on with some of the old diggers and pretty much like, you know what, you know, you're coming up to this, you should be looking at this. So that would be my first thing. The other thing also too though is, and I've really kind of thought long and hard about this over the last couple of years, especially being involved with RSL Victoria. By the way, I do want to say, yes, there are a lot of great people in RSL Victoria and they're doing some great stuff.
Yeah.
So
thanklessly in a lot of cases. Yes. Volunteer.
That's right. Yeah. So from an advice perspective as well. So it's that thing also too that I think us old farts, and I hate to say it, I am there now, looking in the mirror this morning going, yep, you're there.
I can confirm
that's
that.
Right. Yes. Yes. It really is that thing also too, and again, I don't know if it's generationally or what, I think we need to kind of fall off the perch, and like the youngsters honestly have got it all over us. They will look after this planet. But the thing for me is also we need to kind of let go of, first and foremost, our time, what happened to us, all that kind of stuff. And what I mean by that is some of the stuff that so I say that listening to the old farts with tongue in cheek is because some of – and not just the old farts but us old farts – there are times that we kind of get on our high horse and we don't give good advice, or we give good advice but it's labelled or it's put in such a way that, you know, who would want to take that advice? So, and again, I was really thinking about that when I just said that, because I truly do believe that the youngsters, you know, if they do listen to the, you know, kind of the old boys, that there is some great stuff in there. But as I say, it's one of the things, it's like the poison chalice. Mm. Wow, that looks really cool. But you have a taste of it and you go, oh, I've almost died.
Mm.
Like, so, yeah. So I think, and again, it comes back to that whole thing of it's a two-way thing. So not unlike transitions, Defence have got work to do, but so have the ESOs, mm-hmm. and they need to come together. It's the same actually with us individually looking after the youngsters. Yes, I think, you know, the youngsters could be a little more proactive, seeking info, but also too the way that we deliver it needs to actually be better delivered to ensure that it can be received without, you know, as I said, trying to kind of bash it down their throat sort of thing.
Too true. Nicely said. Thank you very, very much, Brett. Mm. I think that is it from us, unless there's anything else Harry would like to add or yourself, Brett.
No, mate. Thanks for coming in. Really appreciate it. And, you know, there might – there's a second part in this, I think, because there is a bit to unpack more in terms of the barriers that Indigenous men and women face and in defence. But we won't let you go without signing our board for this time around.
Oh, okay.
So we'll get you to do that. But thanks so much for coming in, mate. Really appreciate it. Thank you.
I just want to say thank you for the opportunity. It actually, no, I have to admit, I spent a number of years when I first got out and didn't want to discuss my service or anything like that, what have you. So I've come on a bit of a journey with that. But I have to say that you both have made me feel really kind of comfortable and stuff.
Thank you.
It has been a really nice chat.
Good on you, mate.
Appreciate that, Brett. Thank you very, very much.
I've got a shake on that one.
Thank you so, so much. Well, Harry, wasn't that a fascinating conversation? I think there was so much there that we had to sort of cram in. I think we just wanted to keep unpacking so many elements of Brett's story. I think my real takeaway from that is just the real importance that we need to consider in cultural sensitivities and understandings and how that really plays into one's day-to-day health and well-being in a workplace, in every setting all the time.
Yeah, it highlighted to me, firstly, how old I am, but reflecting back into the 80s and 90s, it reminded me of how poor we were at understanding and being able to facilitate Indigenous servicemen and servicewomen. And so it was a real, quite a serious edge to this one. And I enjoyed that. I was also educated. I must say I feel better and know more now after that discussion with Brett. A real trailblazer. Inspired by his father and his heritage, served for nearly 30 years in the Defence Force, and that's no mean feat, and talks and reflects kindly on it. You know, I think there's another episode in this with Brett, because I feel like you said we've crammed so much in, we didn't really get to understand, or there's so much deeper understanding we could take for Indigenous journeys through the Defence Force.
Absolutely, but I am definitely feeling confident at the fact that Brett was comfortable in sharing his story with us to educate people like us on what it means to be an Indigenous man or woman and serve their country and the challenges that are faced along the way. But it gives me hope that by sharing these stories, there is room for improvement and for education and to broaden one's knowledge and understanding in these areas.
Yeah, I'm glad we got him in the RSL and fantastic role model.
Absolutely. If this podcast episode raises any concerns for you, please contact Lifeline on 13 11 14. If you're a current or ex-service member of the ADF or a family member of a veteran or someone who's currently serving, you can access free and confidential 24/7 support from Open Arms Veterans and Families Counselling on 1800 011 046. Current serving members of the ADF and their families can also contact the All Hours Support Line on 1800 628 036 for confidential support. RSL Victoria is here to provide assistance and support to past and present service personnel and their families. Importantly, you don't have to be a member of the RSL to receive assistance from RSL Victoria. You only have to be a current or former member of the Australian Defence Force, our allies, or a dependent of either group. To access RSL support, you can reach out to your closest RSL sub-branch or contact RSL Victoria's Veteran Central Service on 1300 MILVET, 1300 645 838.